Happy Sabbath to everyone. It's good to see you all today. Thank you for the special music. It's always a treat to come to services and to have that special music, and we hope to keep you awake right now. So today I would like to talk to you about a matter that's very important to me. But to begin with, I want to talk about a moment in my life that sometimes haunts me. In fact, it does haunt me, and it helped shape my life. It was a few weeks before our marriage, and my wife had already moved into the apartment. And I was looking forward to going over to the apartment that evening to discuss our wedding, because we were putting on the wedding. We had to get all the events ready, the chairs, everything you think about a wedding, get the cake, make sure the cake's ordered, all the logistics were done. And I was excited about that evening. I got a chance to spend time with my future bride and talk about the wedding, but not only that, talk about the future. And as I walked into the apartment, I sensed something was wrong. And as I walked to the dining room table where she was sitting, she looked up with tears in her eyes. And the question she asked was, what happened? What happened? You see, with the time that led up to that moment wasn't all that bad. I grew up in the Midwest in a blue-collar family. My dad was a machinist. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And we had enough, but we never had much. I remember some of my memories is when my dad would go shopping, or with my mom, we would go get a gallon of milk in those glass jugs, and we'd take it home, and then they would parse it out, put some in a pitcher, add the dry milk, add water, so we could stretch out the food. I remember going to the Dale bread store to get bread. I remember our dessert was a bushel of apples in the fall that somehow you still had to eat in the spring when they were almost like raisins. But we had enough. I know our parents loved us. It was the best they could do. I would wear my brother's clothes in high school, not out of that they were cool. It was because that's all we had. So I went to college. I went to Ambassador College, and I went to Cal State Los Angeles, and I paid for my own college degrees. I had 2 degrees. I paid for them myself. For the Ambassador College, I took a loan. Cal State LA, I was able, you can't do this now, I was able to work 25 hours a week, live with a couple roomies, and pay for my books and tuition. So I would, on Sunday, my big event was to make a pot of chili or spaghetti and then eat it every night throughout the week. That's, you know, it was fine. I actually like spaghetti, still do, and chili. So, but then once I got my job, and I got a job, all of a sudden I had money. And then that fateful day in the mail, the first envelope said, sign up for this credit card. And I did. And I used it. And I signed up for others. And I used them. I took some nice trips. Did a 20-day tour of Alaska. I would eat out probably five, six nights out of the week. Because it was easy. All you had to do was put the card down. And I was living it. Because I deserved it. I went through a blue-collar family where we didn't have much. I went through college. I worked hard, and I deserved it. So I just kept dropping that card. To go back to the event, when we got the new apartment and my wife moved in, I just had all my mail forwarded to the new apartment. So what my future wife, had out on the table was all the bills I had accumulated. And that's why she was crying, because we were underwater even before we said, I do. I was in debt over my head. And the cycle continues. I'd like to read from you a story from an article from Time magazine. Young adults will never pay off their credit cards. by Martha White from Time Magazine. When we talk about Americans barely into adulthood who are saddled with debilitating levels of debt, the conversation is almost always about student loan debt. But there's a growing body of evidence suggesting that today's young adults are also drowning in credit card debt, and that many of them will take this debt to their graves. More than three quarters of renters between the ages of 18 to 24 spend more than they earn every month, according to 1,000 renters of all ages by rent.com. This is the case that though 17% of the respondents in that age bracket say they're willing to live with roommates in order to save money. More than 20% overspent their income by over more than $100. That's every single month. And since they haven't built up credit histories yet, it's a safe bet that these young adults are paying relatively high interest rates on the resulting credit card debt. Although more young people than older adults blame socializing as a barrier to saving money, most young people aren't knocking back $20 drinks in trendy lounges. They're struggling with much more prosaic financial demands. For 42%, rent is their top expense, while 18% say transportation costs eat up the biggest chunk of their earnings, and 22% say paying for food eats up the greatest share of their monthly budget. To a disturbingly large extent, the young and broke are relying on credit cards to make it until their next payday. This obviously isn't sustainable in the long run, and it's going to put a huge drag on this demographic spending power even after they reach their peak earning years, because they will still be paying interest on that carton of OJ or that box of spaghetti they bought a decade earlier. A new study out of Ohio State University found that young adults are racking up credit card debt at more rapid pace than other age groups, and that they're slower at paying it off. If what we found continues to hold true, we may have more elderly people with substantial financial problems in the future, warns Leisha Dunn, co-author and professor of economics at Ohio State University. If our findings persist, we may be faced with a financial crisis among elderly people who cannot pay off their credit cards. And yet credit cards are so easy to use, as I found out. And at times we believe they can assist us to finding a good deal. For example, if we can purchase an item on sale immediately, rather than wait till we have the funds, we might get a good deal. For example, let's say we want to buy a piece of furniture. And let's say the furniture is 20% off that day. Thus, for a piece of furniture worth $1,875, it only costs $1,500, a $375 savings. That is a great deal. So we put it on our credit card. We can't really afford it, but it's such a good deal. And our intent is to pay off that credit card as soon as possible, but we find ourselves only making the minimum payment. In this scenario, what's the real cost of the furniture? There we go. So as you see, the $1,500 here. The fact is, though, we saved $375 in buying the furniture immediately with a credit card. The interest on this transaction is $635. The real cost of the furniture is $2,135, not $1,500 as we originally thought. And it's $260 more that if we would have waited and saved the money to buy it at the non-sale price. The cost of debt is subtle, for we can fail to account for the interest when we buy something, the cost of borrowing when we purchase something with debt. For example, if we buy a home for $500,000 and we get a loan at 5%, for 30 years, what we're really paying for our house is not $500,000, but when we only count interest and principal, we're paying close to $1 million, exactly $966,279. That's the true cost of the home. And I'm not counting insurance and other matters, just principal and interest. That's the true cost, almost $1 million for a $500,000 home. In dealing with debt, however, it's not only the interest that's a factor that should be considered. People can become anxious about debt they owe, discouraged by the inability to pay off the debt he or she has incurred. Debt can weigh on our minds. It can take a toll on marriages, relationship with others, relationship with God. Today I want to explore a biblical perspective of debt. What does the Bible say about debt? So let's look at some interesting slides, quotes about debt. The only man who sticks closer to you in adversity than a friend is a creditor. Bad debt is sacrificing your future day needs for your present day desires. Some debts are fun when you're acquiring them, as I learned, but none are fun when you set about retiring them. Now, when we look at consumer debt in the United States, and consumer debt is credit cards, auto loans, student loans in the United States, it continues to increase, reaching $3.6 trillion in April 2016. And you can see by the bar graph how it's accelerated over time. You see the little blip around 08 when we had the economic crisis, but people rapidly went back to spending with debt going forward. This works out to $11,140 in debt for every man, woman, and child that lives here in the United States. And that $11,140 does not include debt associated with mortgages. Let's look at credit cards at a glance. Number of credit card accounts in the United States, 424 million in the fourth quarter of 2015. With an estimated population in 2015 of 322 million, this amounts to 1.3 credit cards for every man, woman, and child. My wife and I had the pleasure of having a new granddaughter. She has 1.3 credit cards as soon as she was born, attributed to her. Credit card users were mailed 381 million credit card offers in just 1 month, June 2016. National average for credit card rates as of November 2016, 15.8%. Now, can someone tell me what you're getting on your bank accounts and what the difference is? It's a huge difference, 15.8%. For quarter two, 2016, average credit card debt per household with credit card debt, $15,675 billion total. At current credit card interest rates, this amounts to $2,630 in interest payments per year. Total credit card volume in the United States in 2014 was $4 trillion. That's the activity with credit cards. Enough to buy a 2015 Nissan Versa for every man, woman, and child within the United States. Credit cards are used, and they're a part of everyday life. What's the debt burden in U.S. households? And you can see here on the left, you'll notice the dollars in billions, and that's for the bar part of the graph. And then on the right is the percentage growth, and that's the line part of the graph. And as we can see with home mortgages, they grew, and they've been sort of steady ever since economic troubles of FY 08-09, mortgages have maintained to be pretty steady debt. But once again, consumer growth debt has taken off. As you can see by the line credit, the home mortgage growth is around 2%, but consumer credit growth debt, 7%. Now, what about national debt, debt to gross domestic product ratio? The debt to gross domestic product ratio is the ratio of a country's public debt
to its gross domestic product, the GDP. By comparing what a country owes to what it produces, the debt-to-GDP ratio indicates the country's ability to pay back its debt. Gross domestic product is the total value of goods produced and services provided in the country during 1 year. It's everything. And from Investopedia, if a country is unable to pay its debt, it defaults, which could cause a panic in the domestic and international markets. The higher the debt-to-GDP ratio, the less likely the country will pay back its debt, and its higher risk of default. And as we can see, the U.S. debt, the government debt, since 2006, has grown to over 104% of our gross domestic product. That means if everybody, all the goods and services, we put it all just to paying off a debt, would take over a year in the United States. And it's growing, as you can see. And who owns the U.S. debt? Well, 34% is owned by foreign countries. And I was at a seminar a while ago, not too long ago, where this individual who consults on Capitol Hill expressed concern that our foreign policy might be dictated by those who hold our debt. But you can see who holds the debt. And now this is an old version, March 31, 2013, $16.8 trillion. It's higher than that now. Now how much is a trillion? If someone were to spend $1 million per hour, you wouldn't reach $1 trillion for 411 years. If you lived to 80 years of age, to get to $1 trillion, you would have to save $34 million each day of your life. That's how much you would have to save to get to $1 trillion. Now, and this map is interesting. It's a spread out map, but it shows the countries and their respective debt ratios. You can see in this debt, in this one, the United States is at 102%. You can see Japan is at 230%. It would take 2 years if they put everything they produce to paying off the debt. Now, the countries in red are those who have their growth rates are less than zero. How can you pay off debt if you're shrinking? Thus, the world has debt and uses debt. And you can see here who has the debt in the world. This is at 59.7. Again, that's old data. It increases by the day. But the United States has the majority of the debt, then Japan, and then many other countries have a component of that debt. So the United Nations of Debt, this is from the Visual Capitalist in August 2015, states the numbers that stand out from that previous chart out the most, especially when comparing to the previous world economy graphic, the United States constitutes 23.3% of the world economy, but 29.1% of the world debt. Its debt to GDP ratio is 103.4% using IMF figures. Japan makes up only 6.18% of total economic production, but it has amounted 19.99% of global debt. China, the world's second largest economy and largest by other measures, accounts for 13.9% of production. They only have 6.25% of world debt, and a debt-to-GDP ratio of only 39.4%. Seven of the 15 countries with the most debt are European. Together, excluding Russia, the European continent holds 26% of the world debt. Now, what does that mean? If you want to go to this website, not during this message, but it's the Global Debt Clock, www.nationaldebtclocks.org, you'll find that the U.S. debt is at now $19.8 trillion, and the global debt is $62.5 trillion. It can be safely said that individually, nationally, internationally, we are a people addicted to debt. Today, I would like to examine the Bible's perspective of debt. And this message is really the first of two parts. and it will involve three sections. First, I want to probe the question, does the Bible prohibit debt? Second, I will go on to discuss the danger of debt, and three, underlying factors leading to unmanageable debt. So to start, does the Bible prohibit debt? Well, it does not. However, when debt is mentioned, it's generally discussed in a negative light. The main reason for this is it makes the holder of the debt a servant to someone other than God. If you turn to Proverbs 22, verse 7, Proverbs 22, verse 7, and maybe we can have the lights up a little bit now, because the majority of the slideshow is done, and it doesn't. Proverbs 22, verse 7. And we know this one. It says, Proverbs 22, verse 7, the rich rule over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. The term for servant in Hebrew means bondage or bond servant. We can look back at ancient Israel to see how debt was administered. If we would turn to Leviticus 25, verse 35. Leviticus 25, verse 35. And I'll read from the New Living Translation, Leviticus 25, verse 35. It states, if one of your fellow Israelites falls into poverty and cannot support himself, support him as you would a foreigner or a temporary resident and allow him to live with you. Do not charge interest or make a profit at his expense. Instead, show your fear of God by letting him live with you as your relative. Remember, do not charge interest on money you lend him or make profit on food you sell him. Here we see if there was an Israelite, one in the, who was poor, they had a responsibility to help that individual, and that included the lending of money. However, as we see, they were not to be charging interest because it wasn't to take advantage of the poor. It was to help them. However, there were times when the borrower was not able to pay back the loan. Then a form of slavery or indentured servitude was allowed. Turn to Deuteronomy 15, verse 1. Deuteronomy 15, verse 1. Deuteronomy 15, verse 1. And I'd like to read from the New Living Translation. At the end of every seventh year, you must cancel the debts of everyone who owes you money. This is how it must be done. Everyone must cancel the loans they have made to their fellow Israelites. They must not demand payment from their neighbors or relatives, for the Lord's time of release has arrived. In verse 3, this release from debt, however, applies to your fellow Israelites, not to the foreigners living among you. Again, I just make the point that there was no prohibition against borrowing or lending in Israel, even to foreigners. Verse 4, there should be no poor among you, for the Lord your God will greatly bless you in the land he has given you as a special possession. You will receive this blessing if you're careful to obey all the commands the Lord your God that I am giving to you today. The Lord your God will bless you as he promised. You will lend money to many nations, but you will never need to borrow. You will rule many nations, but they will not rule over you. We can just read the principle in verse 6. The lending of money, the borrowing of money, is the one who has control over your life. And we can see this principle about borrowing. We read in verse 6 right there. Verse 7. But if there are any poor Israelites in your town when you arrive in the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted toward them. Instead, be generous and lend them whatever they need. Do not be mean-spirited or refuse someone a loan because the year for canceling debt is close at hand. If you refuse to make the loan and the needy person cries out to the Lord, you will be considered guilty of sin. Give generously to the poor, not grudgingly, for the Lord your God will bless you in everything you do. There will always be some in the land who are poor. That's why I'm commanding you to share freely with the poor and other Israelites in need. In the lending of the money, God did not permit the mistreatment of the poor. In fact, the principle was to forgive the loan if not repaid within the seven-year time period. But in the borrowing of the money, the principle was that the money was to be repaid. There was a forgiveness, as we see, a reset for the individual who incurred the debt if they were unable to pay the debt. But in the meantime, the debtor was expected to pay the debt back. If not, there would be a form of slavery, indentured servitude imposed. Turn to verse 12 of Deuteronomy 15, go down there, and I like to read from the International Version. If any of your people, Hebrew men or women, sell themselves to you and serve you 6 years, in the seventh year you must let them go free. So there was indentured servitude. And when you release them, do not send them away empty-handed. Supply them liberally from your flock, your threshing floor, or your winepress. Give to them as the Lord has blessed you. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord has redeemed you. That is why I give you this command today. So God provided a framework in which Israelites who were less fortunate were able to obtain loans. But there were some stipulations with regard to the borrowing of money. There was not to be any interest paid. If the borrower defaulted, he could be sold into slavery or an indentured servitude. It had a 6-year limit. The creditor had to supply tools of production to the indentured servant at the end of the period of slavery. Otherwise, they would just relapse back into debt once again. And the day of release was on the Day of Atonement in the nation's seventh and sabbatical year. The point I want to make here is there was an obligation to repay the lender. It was a serious obligation, so much so that if the person was unable to pay, they would be indentured to the lender until the debt was paid. It wasn't a system of welfare, entitlement, or free money. There was an obligation to repay the lender. But there was also, mercifully, a reset. If the person could not repay, there was a time to forgive and reestablish the individual. The burden was released. Even in the New Testament, there's a principle to repay what's been owed. Turn to Romans 13, verse 7. Romans 13, verse 7. Romans 13, verse 7. It states in Romans 13, verse 7, render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. There's a principle in the Bible to repay debts. It's an obligation we take on when we use someone else's money. So when we borrow, we effectively become a servant to the bank, or we can become a servant to a family member or a friend. Whoever we borrowed from, we have to think of it in that way, because we have an obligation to pay back the funds we received. That's why, as you will see in the sermon, God, through the Bible, counsels us to avoid debt, because it shackles us. The more debt we have, the more we're in financial bondage, and the more we become servants of someone else than servants of God. Matthew Henry, in commenting on Proverbs 22:7, makes the following poignant comment. Some sell their liberty to gratify their luxury. There's an old German proverb, he who borrows sells his freedom. And the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is a servant to the lender. Proverbs 22, verse 7. As we see, God had a system in ancient Israel that allowed lending and borrowing, but there was an obligation to repay the lender. And sometimes that obligation was through slavery. So what are the dangers of debt? Why should we even discuss this matter today? Besides being a servant to a lender and having our minds distracted for our purpose on this earth, debt can impair our ability to provide for our families. We have to look at interest on debt for what it is. It's the payment to someone else for the use of their money. It's cash out of our earnings for the privilege of borrowing money. In effect, interest payments lower our ability to provide for our families. For example, if we're paying $200 in credit card interest a month, that is $200 that's not available for our families. That is $200 that's not available for clothes. That is $200 that's not available to be saved. In effect, it reduces our earnings. For we get nothing tangible for paying interest. It's money out the door. Now, I know in some cases we can't avoid going into debt, such as a home mortgage or an automobile loan or if emergency arises, and I'm not saying that. But we need to remind ourselves that when we go into debt, we are paying interest, which is a payment for the use of someone else's money, and it effectively reduces our ability to provide for ourselves and our family. That's why we need to consider any debt, whether it's home mortgage, auto loan, student loan, or even down to a credit card purchase, very carefully. Are we so tied down by debt, paying so much interest, that we cannot adequately provide for our families? Turn to 1 Timothy 5, verse 8. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8. But if anyone does not provide for his own and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Are we so burdened down by debt that we cannot leave a financial legacy for our children or for our grandchildren? Proverbs 13:22 says, "A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous." We know that it's our legacy that we leave to our children is much more than financial. It's our character. It's the things we can teach them. But there really is a financial element to this. Do we have a fund or a trust set up for our children's education or our grandchildren's education? Are we neglecting to provide our children because of our spending habits today? Are we saving enough for them? Do we have enough to provide a legacy for future generations? Doesn't mean we have to accumulate massive wealth at this time, but we shouldn't be spending money like there is no tomorrow. Are we so engaged in the here and now, what we can attain now, what we're entitled to now, that we fail to leave a financial legacy to our children and our grandchildren? Matthew 6, verse 24. Matthew 6, verse 24. And I'd like to read from the English Standard Version, Matthew 6, verse 24. It states in Matthew 6, verse 24, "No one can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other." You cannot serve God and money. The danger of debt is that we can become so overwhelmed with the pressure of paying bills, of trying to make payments, that it takes a toll on us mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually. And it can take a toll on our families and our marriages. I would like to read an excerpt from an article from CNBC entitled "Fighting with Your Spouse." It's probably about this, by Kelly Holland, on February 4th, 2015 article. Finances are the leading cause of stress in a relationship, according to a survey of people in a relationship or partnership released Wednesday by the SunTrust Bank. Some 35% of all respondents experienced relation stress said that money was the primary cause of friction. Annoying habits come in at second, at 25%, and I got a inside track on that one. Among respondents with relationship stress aged 44 to 54, 44% said money was the primary cause. Money touches everything. It impacts people's lives, said Emmett Burns, the brand marketing director for SunTrust. Money and stress do go hand in hand for many Americans, whether they're in a relationship or not. A study released earlier this week by American Psychological Association found that almost three-quarters of Americans are experiencing financial stress at least some of the time, and nearly a quarter of us are feeling extreme financial stress. We may be some in this room here today. And financial stresses can impact our relationship with God. We can become distracted, discouraged, angry, depressed at the situation we find ourselves. Another quote, "This would be a much better world if more married couples were as deeply in love as they are in debt." I think that's a good comment. At this time, I'd like to discuss some of the underlying factors that result in unmanageable debt. First, the first underlying factor in unmanageable debt is the lack of being content. The lack of being content. In his time on earth, Christ warned us about greed and discontent regarding possessions and our place in society. Turn to Luke 12, verse 15. Luke 12, verse 15. Luke 12, verse 15. "And he said to them, 'Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of things he possesses.'" Being content is one of the most distinguishing traits of a godly person, because the person can focus on good rather than on possessions or power. What does such a commitment do for us? It frees us for right choices. It changes our vision of who we are as sojourners on this earth and why we are here. It enables us to look life in a different way. If we're so focused on things, on possessions, on power, we lose track of who we are as ambassadors for Christ. Now, the freedom which I speak does not consist of what I want to do, but it's what I ought to do, what I was designed to do by the strength that God gives us. The converse of contentment is covetousness, and covetousness has in its root discontent, seeking our happiness, our peace, our well-being, money, power, possessions. But it's a mirage that can never be fulfilled, and which will always escape us, because only God's way of life, living that way of life, can bring us true happiness and meaning. In the end, we perish, and the only thing we can take with us is the character we build. The rest is left behind. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. And I like to read from the English Standard Version. "Now there is great pain in godliness with contentment, for we brought nothing into this world, and we can't take anything out of this world. But if we have food and clothing, with these things we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction." That doesn't mean that things we attain can't bring us some level of joy or security to our life. And indeed, we see scriptures that tell us we should prosper in this life. Turn to 3 John, verse 2. 3 John, there's no chapters, just verse 2. 3 John, verse 2. And it states, "Beloved, I pray that you may prosper and in all things, and be in health, just as your soul prospers." There's no prohibition about prospering in this life. But prosperity is more than just wealth. It's a lifestyle that has a healthy relationship with God. It has a mind of peace. There's joy. There's happiness. The term shalom is used throughout the Bible, and it means nothing missing, nothing broken. It's complete wholeness. It's true prosperity. And indeed, that's the prosperity we should seek. A second underlying factor of not being able to manage debt is not to be able to discern needs from wants. We have a hard time discerning needs from wants. Well, what's a need? Let's start by defining need. In the strictest sense of the word, a need is something you have to have in order to get by in this world. It's a necessity. In our personal life, we need food. We need shelter. We need clothing. We need medical care. The basics. You will probably, and we will probably experience some sort of physical suffering of some sort if we don't meet our needs. A want, on the other hand, is something we desire, something we would like to have. But we don't really suffer for it in any other way than maybe mental anguish if we don't get what we want. Wants also quite often fall into the category of luxuries. It's nice to have, but the world won't end without them. For example, having food is a need. We can't survive without it. Eating out is a want. We don't need to eat out to survive. Having shelter is a need. Having a home on the beach is a want. Having transportation is basically a need in this society. However, having a new car with leather interiors and the latest gadgetry, well, that's a want. Knowing the difference between needs and wants is an important part to learning how to manage finances, especially in tough economic times. It's very easy to spend money. I did it. What's not so easy is spending money wisely. One way to help us spend wisely is to separate our needs from our wants and to focus our money on our needs. If we are in debt, reduce spending on wants and divert those funds to get out of debt. Now, going back to the story I started with, as I walked into the room and I saw my future bride with tears in her eyes, we sat there and decided that we would tackle that debt because we knew we couldn't really start a family or have a home by having that level of debt. So what we did is we took one paycheck and we set it aside just to pay off my debt. And I'm sickened by that. For our first year of marriage, I don't remember much other than going to the local delicatessen. We had a rule that the only way we could go out to eat is we would take our coin jar. Now, you got to remember, I probably ate out 5 nights a week with the credit card. So to go with pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters to buy a sandwich was humiliating. But it was a good lesson. And it took us a little over a year of having one income just paying off my debt. But we did it. Was it hard? Yes. There are not a lot of joyful memories during those times of trips or big events. But I do remember those turkey with cranberry sandwiches very fondly at the delicatessen. And we were able to buy a home and to start a family. In order to evaluate our needs from our wants, I recommend putting together a worksheet on our current spending. On the left side, write needs. Then produce some items that you currently spend with needs and then estimate your monthly costs. On the right side, write wants and then estimate your monthly costs for those. And then go and think through and analyze the expenses accordingly. I will be surprised how much we spend on wants rather than needs. A third underlying factor of not being able to manage debt is being fiscally immature. Being fiscally immature. Now, no one likes being called immature, but isn't the mishandling of funds we've been given, no matter how meager or how much we have, a sign of immaturity? Turn to Luke 14, verse 28. Luke 14, verse 28. Luke 14, verse 28. It states in Luke 14, verse 28, "For which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all those see him mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.'" The Gospel according to Luke by James Edwards provides the following commentary. One must sit down and estimate the cost. The Greek word for estimate refers to counting with pebbles and was used in antiquity for tallying business assets or casting a vote. Both matter to which hearers were advised to give considered attention. The building required a foundation, the response to dig a deep and build it on bedrock. Anyone who undertakes such a project with less resolve would not finish it and end up the laughing stock of the county. We realize that this parable refers to a spiritual principle about counting the costs, but it also applies to our counting our costs with regard to our financial situation. Do we adjust our lifestyle based on our ability to pay? Do we lower our standard of living when we have a financial downturn in our lives? I would like to read from an article from John Hansen entitled, "For Who Am I Working?" It's a little lengthy, and bear with me as I read it, but it really brings out what I felt were important principles that I would like for us to consider. Many people work hard to have luxuries, only to become slaves to those luxuries. In The Art of Getting Money, P.T. Barnum wrote, "Debt robs a man of his self-respect and makes him almost despise himself." You may well ask, do I have my possessions or do they have me? After a few years of prosperity, this is the question I asked myself. No matter how low a wage you are earning, success is within your reach. Many people refuse to believe this since they're already living at the financial edge. You probably have everything you need. You may be just using your resources ineffectively. Some people think that success will start only when they begin to earn a certain dollar amount or when some future event saves them. The problem with such thinking is if you wait to start, you may carry forward such poor financial habits that even when, or more to the point, if this dollar amount ever or event happens, it will not be enough to overcome the poor habits you acquired while waiting. The notion, "I do not make enough," is more popular than the supremely accurate notion, "I have poor spending habits." The article goes on. Those choosing to live hand-to-mouth will always be a financially inferior class compared to those who take the time to plan, save, organize, and invest. Some of us compound the problem by choosing to live not only financially hand-to-mouth, but also intellectually and spiritually hand-to-mouth, never building a reserve of knowledge and faith for use beyond the immediate moment. To be sure, your intellectual and spiritual development may be nurtured independently of your finances, but the most successful people build all three simultaneously. As an analogy, think of how a cable or rope is made, with all three strands of the cable representing your financial, intellectual, and spiritual sides. When all three of these are woven together, they produce a cord that is not easily broken. And the article continues. Two main spending habit styles are the consumerate and the econowise. Consumerate spend all the money they have, and they are overspenders. Many consumerate adopt a consumer entitlement mentality, eventually believing they not only need but also deserve everything they want. The consumerate avoid the three D's of discipline, deferral, and discernment, while embracing the three I's, indifference, immediacy, and ignorance. I do not mean by ignorance that the consumerate are literally ignorant. I mean that by design they choose to be ignorant in the area of personal finance. Just by being unaware, you are ignorant. It is an ignorance of information, not a lack of intelligence. I'm urging you to avoid willful ignorance. The econowise, on the other hand, plans for life's demands. They seek economy and wisdom. The question the economist asks at the beginning of every spending situation is, does this take me nearer or farther from my goals? A constant training in the economist habits is desirable. Make it a part of your internal dialogue. The economist, of course, embraces discipline, deferral, and discernment. The last piece of the article goes as follows. If you have worked for many years and have little or nothing to show for your efforts because you don't know the fundamentals of spending or you choose to ignore them. It may be a matter of financial immaturity, or perhaps you've never been made aware of the fundamentals. Financial immaturity is the major reason people do not plan for the future. Awareness is the easy part. That's the good news. The ongoing work of leading the life of EconoWise involves awareness of the debt, effects, monitoring your burn rate, and having a spending plan in place, and having a written plan for an end game. For an EconoWise, the end game begins when passive income exceeds their needs and they're able to do as they wish. Please don't misunderstand. I'm not against work, just against the forced work due to being a slave to one's desires. And the Bible backs the author with Proverbs 22, verse 3. There's no need to turn there, but it's also repeated in Proverbs 27, verse 12. The prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. What are we? Are we consumerati or econo-wise? Will we manage our futures, or will our future manage us? Do we manage our desires, or do our desires manage us? In this message, we explored three aspects of debt as it relates to the Bible. First of all, we noted that the Bible does not prohibit debt. However, there's an obligation to pay the lender. With regard to, we explored the danger of debt, and we discussed that the danger of debt is becoming so overwhelmed with the pressures of paying bills, of trying to meet payments, that it takes a toll on us mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Finally, we examined underlying factors leading to unmanageable debt. First, underlying factor in unmanageable debt, lack of being content. The second underlying factor of not being able to manage debt is not being able to discern needs from wants. And the third underlying factor of not being able to manage debt is being fiscally immature. In our life, we will deal with debt. In my next message, we will explore biblical principles relating to the management of debt.